I would have liked hearing that better. I mean, I've never seen you with a girl. What a waste. You could have gotten any girl you wanted if you'd gone to a Japanese university. There isn't anyone like you. Why did you have to die, Jong-il? It's going to be pretty tough doing this alone. Why did you have to die? I closed my eyes, took a deep breath, and got up off the stairs. I went down the rest of the stairs to the platform and looked for a payphone. Spotting one next to a kiosk, I started walking. As soon as I grabbed the receiver off the cradle, I realized I'd forgotten my telephone card at home and stuck my hand in my pockets for some change. I couldn't find any 10-yen coins, so I dropped a 100-yen coin and slowly pushed the numbers for Sakurai's house. Sakurai was supposed to be out at the opera. We met at a cafe near Ginza Yonchome.
I saw this show the other day about how the direct ancestor of modern humans isn't Peking man or Neanderthal man, but the Australopithecines that originated on the African continent 2 million years ago. They figured this out by comparing the Neanderthal to modern human mitochondrial DNA sequences. It's all pretty complicated, so I'll explain mitochondrial DNA to you another time. The Australopithecines, originating in Africa, continued to evolve until they came to be the genus Homo. Gradually, there were groups that moved out of Africa and spread all over the world. This migration might have been caused by a power struggle, or maybe climate change was the cause. When the Earth entered the Ice Age roughly 130,000 years ago, and Africa became too cold, humans might have set off for warmer places. I actually think we migrated for completely different reasons, but I'll tell you about that later. The humans, leaving Africa, eventually split into two groups somewhere in the Middle East. One headed for Europe and the other for Asia. This split marked the beginning of the so-called Caucasoid race and us, the Mongoloid race. The group that chose to become the Mongoloid race headed down into Asia, while gradually adapting their body and facial features according to the environment. They never stopped moving their feet. When parents died, their children took over and kept on moving. Then, at the end of nearly 100,000 years and tens of thousands of miles, a group of Mongoloids found themselves in Japan. This group would later come to be known as the Jomon people and were the ancient inhabitants of Japan. Normally, the story would end happily ever after here, but this is where it gets interesting. There were some that didn't stop moving even after getting to the Far East. They traveled up the Eurasian continent until they reached Siberia and walked across the Bering Land Bridge, which was exposed when the sea level dropped during the last ice age, and to the westernmost part of the American continent, Alaska. But they weren't satisfied with just crossing to the Americas. They began to move south, down the length of the continent, founding the Mayan and Aztec civilizations along the way. And then they reached the southern edge of South America. It was a journey that took generation after generation to finish, but the courage and glory of those humans who took the first steps remain in the bodies of their descendants. Research proved that these people belong to the same group as the Mongoloids who stayed in Japan. A comparison between the mitochondrial DNA sequences of the Ainu, descended from the Jomon people, and the indigenous people of the Andes showed them to be basically the same. Isn't that amazing? If you count the distance from Africa, that's a journey of 15,000 miles. And you know what? I don't believe that a power struggle or the declining environment was what pushed them to travel all that way. They just had to see what kind of place the edge of the earth was. I'm sure of it. And the genes encoded with this ridiculously simple impulse remained no matter how many generations passed. Besides, humans never had it in them to settle in one place. And then something called agriculture was invented. So, what are you trying to say, Sugihara? asked Sakurai, a gentle smile floating across her lips.
What I'm trying to say, I said, looking her in the eyes, is that they're really cool, and I want to be like them.
Her smile grew wider as she said,
You're just trying to impress me, right?
I nodded earnestly. After letting out a giggle, she peered into my eyes and said,
I saw this show the other day about a retirement home for guide dogs in Hokkaido. It's this place where old dogs that can't do their job anymore can go to live out their last days. The fact that a place like that even existed moved me so much that I couldn't take my eyes off the TV. And then they showed a woman saying goodbye to her guide dog. It was a blind woman and a male golden retriever couple. And she just held him in her arms, completely still, for a good hour, until finally the staff had to pull them apart. As the car drove away from the retirement home, the woman leaned out of the window and waved, shouting, See you, and bye-bye, and the dog's name. But the dog just sat there and watched the car go. But that's the way it had to be. It's how guide dogs are trained. They aren't allowed to show any excitement, and they aren't allowed to bark. Even after the car was gone, the dog didn't move an inch from where they said their goodbyes, and he kept looking in the direction the car disappeared. For hours. The woman who'd been by his side for 10 years wasn't there anymore. He must have been so devastated he couldn't move. They said goodbye around noon, and in the evening it started to rain, really hard. The dog that had been looking straight ahead until then looked up like he was watching the rain come down and started to howl. Woan! Woan! Like that. Again and again. He didn't look the least bit sad or pathetic. He bayed with his back stretched, and the line from his chest to his chin perfectly straight like a beautiful sculpture. I cried my eyes out. Woan! Woan! Just like that.
So, what are you trying to say, Sakurai? I asked.
I'm trying to say that I want to love someone the way that dog did. His howl was more beautiful than any music I've ever heard. I want to be the kind of person that can love someone right and then cry the way that dog did if I lost someone. Do you understand what I'm getting at?
After giving her a firm nod, I reached out and put my hand over Sakurai's on the table. For a while, we looked into each other's eyes and said nothing. The cafe waiter came by and refilled our water glasses. Sakurai said,
You've been looking like you're about to cry.
Really?
Yeah.
She looked down, averting her eyes from mine, and let out a breath. Her chest shook slightly. When I asked, What's the matter? She looked up and stared into my eyes.
Would you like me to be with you tonight?
Huh?
I can stay with you until you go to sleep and wake up.
Are you sure?
Please, don't make me say it again.
We left the cafe and headed for Yurakucho Station. While Sakurai called home from a payphone inside the station, I went to put my school uniform jacket in a pay locker nearby. I stood in front of the coin-operated locker and took out 2 envelopes from my inner pocket. With me arriving late to the funeral and the run-in with Wonsu, I'd forgotten to give Jong-il's mom my condolence money. First, I pulled out 30,000 yen of my own money from 1 envelope and put it in my pants pocket. Then I opened the envelope my father had given me. He couldn't go to the funeral on account of urgent business. There were 10 crisp 10,000 yen bills inside. I put them in my pocket too. I had a feeling Jong-il and my father would forgive me. When I returned to the station, Sakurai was still on the phone. I glanced at the clock on the wall. It was 10 minutes to 10. At exactly 10 o'clock, Sakurai finished her call and came running back. Any trouble? Sakurai hastily shook her head. Everything's great. I told my father that I was staying at a friend's house. We headed for the Imperial Hotel. Since we weren't doing anything wrong, I walked right into the lobby without caring too much about being in shirt sleeves and my school trousers. I parted with Sakurai at the lobby and asked her to wait on the sofa near the tea room. I walked up to the front desk. Showing no hint of surprise at the sight of me, the young clerk bowed politely, saying, "Welcome."
"I'd like a room, please," I said.
"Do you have a reservation?"
"No."
And then, for the next couple of minutes, he gave me a rundown of the various room types and prices. The prices varied according to what floor the room was on and which way it was facing. After a careful consultation with the clerk, I decided on a deluxe room on the 12th floor facing Hibiya Park. The view was apparently very nice. The condolence money would more than cover the cost.
"Will you be paying with a credit card or cash?" asked the clerk.
"Cash." I stuck a hand in my pocket, thinking payment had to be made up front, but the clerk said the bill would be settled when I checked out. Next, the clerk handed me a guest card, so I began filling it out. To avoid any hassle, I decided to pretend Sakurai and I were married and put down Sugihara for both our last names. The problem was with Sakurai's first name, and since it would be weird to go ask her, I decided to give her a random name. So she became Keiko. I got the room key and walked away. I found Sakurai, and we boarded the elevator and went up to the 12th floor. We walked past the floor receptionist, down the long corridor, and stood in front of the door of our room. I opened the door, and we went inside. When the door closed behind us, Sakurai and I let out a sigh almost at the same time.
"Wow, that was nerve-wracking," she said, smiling.
I nodded. The tastefully decorated hotel room was larger than any I'd ever stayed in. There was a sturdy-looking wood writing desk, a sturdy-looking sofa set, and sturdy-looking picture frames hanging on the walls. Restless, Sakurai and I lost interest in the sturdy-looking furniture and furnishings and went to the bed. We took off our shoes and hopped up on the double bed, as if it were expected, and jumped up and down like kids. Sakurai nimbly slipped off the red cardigan she was wearing and tossed it toward the wall. Dressed only in a white dress now, she kept on jumping without caring that her panties peeked out from beneath her dress every time she landed. She looked really happy. After we'd jumped up and down about 30 times and started to lose our breath, Sakurai dove into me. I caught her in midair, and we landed back on the bed together. We stood on the bed, breathless, and stared into each other's eyes. Suddenly, Sakurai planted her lips on mine. We kissed long and hard, our tongues tangling. A couple of times, we unlocked lips to come up for air and then went back to kissing again. I placed my hands on her waist and moved my thumbs up and down, which made her pull her lips away from mine and rest her head on my chest. A breathy gasp escaped her lips. Slowly, I ran my hands down her body, grabbed the hem of her dress, and slowly hiked it up. Sakurai raised her arms above her head in a banzai pose. I lifted the dress over her head and tossed it toward the wall. Stripped down to her underwear and bra now, Sakurai put her hands on the front of my shirt. She undid each button carefully. I let Sakurai take off my shirt and tank top. She dropped them next to the bed and reached for my belt.
"I'll get out of these myself," I said.
Sakurai chuckled and jumped off the bed. She went to the wall, reached for the light switch, and turned off the light. She sat down on the bed and unhooked her bra. I stepped down from the bed and took off my pants and socks in the dark. I wondered about my boxers, but decided to keep them on. When I turned to the bed, I found Sakurai lying on her back. My eyes were getting used to the dark. Lying down on the bed next to Sakurai, I gently traced the curves of her face with my right thumb. Her forehead, brows, eyes, nose, cheeks, lips. Afterward, I kissed each of those parts gently. Sakurai's breathing was steady and light. Holding her by the shoulders, I slowly turned her over so she was lying on her stomach. First, I ran my tongue over the nape of her neck, occasionally giving her earlobes a light nip. Sakurai's breathing grew erratic, rough. Taking my lips off the nape of her neck, I put my left thumb there instead and moved it up and down, right and left. Then I put my lips on the dip of her back and licked it. She tasted more gamey than grassy. My tongue ran down the dip, making her body twitch occasionally. Her midriff heaved up and down every time she took a heavy breath, my head going up and down along with her. Sakurai's right hand, which was stretched out above her, slowly crept down the bed. Once her hand reached bottom, it moved right and left in search of something. When I brought my free hand closer to hers, she grabbed my hand with surprising force and brought it up toward her face. She turned her head to the side and bit my hand hard. As the sharp pain registered in my brain, my tongue moved faster on her back. I felt Sakurai's breath on the back of my hand. I removed my tongue from the hollow of her back and propped myself up. I put my hand on her shoulder and rolled Sakurai over on her back. She quit biting my hand and said, "I'm crazy about you." For an instant, Sakurai's eyes seemed to flash red. I was madly in love with this woman, this luminous body lying before me. I had to tell her. I didn't want to hide anything from her. I sat up on the bed with my legs folded beneath me. "What's the matter?" asked Sakurai. "I'm sorry." Sakurai let go of my right hand. I said, "There's something I want you to know." Propping her elbows against the bed, Sakurai slowly brought herself up to a sitting position.
"Know what?"
"There's something I've been hiding."
"What is it?"
All of a sudden, Sakurai's voice was filled with worry.
"What is it?"
Seeing me struggling to get out the words, she said half-jokingly, "Do you have a criminal record or something?" "I've been reprimanded a bunch of times, but no record yet."
"Oh, okay," Sakurai said. "Is it about your family?"
"I can't say that it isn't."
"Does your father have a criminal record?"
"My father can be rough, but he's also righteous."
"Your mother has a record?"
"You're kidding, right?"
"Sugihara," Sakurai said, letting out a sigh. "Can you imagine how awkward this would be if I wasn't kidding just a little?"
"I guess."
"Come on, you can tell me. Then we can go back to what we were doing."
For an instant, I considered sweeping it all under the rug by saying, "It's nothing. Now, where were we?" But I was afraid that I might never tell her if I missed this chance. Besides, I believed she would accept anything I told her. And then she would say this,
"So what? Now let's go back to what we were doing."
I took a breath so deep that Sakurai noticed, and I said, I'm not Japanese." The silence must have gone on for only about 10 seconds, but to me, it seemed much longer.
"What do you mean?" asked Sakurai.
"My nationality isn't Japanese."
"Then what is it?"
"South Korean." Sakurai drew her legs, which had been stuck straight out at me, back to her chest and sat with her arms wrapped tightly around them. Her body looked terribly small. I said, "But I was North Korean until the second year of junior high. 3 months from now, I may be Japanese. In a year, I may be American. And I may be Norwegian when I die."
"What are you saying?"
Sakurai asked in a flat voice. My heart began to beat faster. "That nationality doesn't mean anything." Silence. 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 Finally, Sakurai opened her mouth.
"You were born in Japan and raised in Japan?"
I nodded and said, "I grew up breathing pretty much the same air as you did and eating pretty much the same foods you did. but we were educated differently. I went to North Korean school until high school. That's where I learned to speak Korean. After getting out that much, I joked, I'm actually bilingual. Although I guess in Japan, you only call someone who speaks English bilingual. When I'm watching the Olympics, I can cheer on both Japanese and Korean athletes in their language. Don't you think that's great? Sakurai didn't even crack a smile. She was looking at me, emotionless. The silence was terrifying. My heart beat even faster. Faster even than the first time a knife was drawn on me. I searched desperately for something to say, but I was out of luck. A terrible feeling of uneasiness came over me and spread through my entire body, weighing me down. Slowly I stretched my hand out toward her. Sakurai's body flinched. My hand stopped in midair, even though my brain was telling it to move. I lowered my hand and asked, "Why?" Sakurai's mouth opened and closed slightly, as though she were trying to say something. Whatever that something might be, I just wanted to hear her voice. I gently asked her what was wrong to try to coax her. Lowering her eyes, Sakurai said, "My father. Since I was little, my father told me that I couldn't go out with Korean or Chinese men." After I managed to take that in, I asked, "Is there a reason why?" Sakurai fell silent, so I continued, "Was your father treated badly by a Korean or Chinese person or something? Even if that were the case, I'm not the one who treated your father badly."
"It's not that," Sakurai said weakly.
"Then what?"
"He told me that Korean and Chinese people have tainted blood."
Her words didn't shock me. They were merely words uttered from ignorance and prejudice. It was all too easy to deny such irresponsible words. I said, "Tell me, what's the distinction? How do you decide he's Japanese or she's Korean or he's Chinese?
How?
Is it nationality? Like I said before, you can change your nationality easily."
"Where they were born, or the language they speak."
"Then what about returnee kids, born and raised in another country because of their parents' work, who have citizenship in another country? Are they not Japanese?"
"I guess if their parents are Japanese, they're Japanese too."
"So basically, who you are has to do with your roots. Then maybe I should ask how far you have to go back to know your roots. If you found out that your great-grandfather had Chinese blood in him, would you stop being Japanese?" Sakurai didn't speak. "Or are you Japanese anyway, because you were born and raised in Japan and you speak Japanese? Then that would mean I'm Japanese too."
"It isn't possible my great-grandfather had Chinese blood," she said, with a hint of displeasure in her voice.
"You're wrong," I said a bit firmly. "Your family name, Sakurai, was a name given to people who originally came from China. It's all in the New Selection and Record of Hereditary Titles and Family Names, compiled during the Heian period."
"I thought that in the past, people didn't have family names, and they randomly gave them to themselves. So there's no way to tell if my ancestors were Chinese at all."
"Exactly. It's also possible that one of your ancestors was adopted into the Sakurai family.
Then let's go back further.
Your family can't drink alcohol, right?" Sakurai nodded slightly. I continued, "The Jomon people are believed to be the direct ancestors of modern Japanese, and there wasn't a single person among them that couldn't drink alcohol. That was proven by DNA research. In fact, all Mongoloids were capable of drinking in ancient times. But then, about 25,000 years ago, a human with a gene mutation was born in northern China. That human was born with a low tolerance for alcohol. At some point, that person's descendants came to Japan and spread the low tolerance for alcohol gene. And you've inherited that gene. Does that mean your blood containing this Chinese-born gene is tainted?
Silence. I sat motionless and waited for Sakurai to speak. Finally, she let out a long, long breath and said,
"You know so much about so many things, but this isn't about any of that. I get what you're trying to say intellectually, but I can't. I'm scared. When I think about you entering my body, I'm scared."
My heart gradually went back down to its normal beat, and the uneasiness weighing me down began to fade at the same time. I let out a much, much longer breath than Sakurai's. I turned my back to her and climbed off the bed. I picked up the white tank top, which stood out in the darkness, and put it on.
Sakurai said, "Why did you keep this from me for this long? If you didn't think it was such a big deal, you could have told me."
I picked up my shirt and slipped my arms through the sleeves. Then I buttoned up the front.
Sakurai continued, "It's not fair. The way you just dropped this on me and ruined everything."
I looked for my socks, thinking to put them on before my pants, but I couldn't find them. I crouched down and combed the floor with my hands. They were nowhere to be found. Seeing my confusion, Sakurai said,
"They're probably in the legs of your pants."
I grabbed my pants and stuck my hand in the legs. There they were.
Sakurai said, "Boys usually panic and rush to take off their pants and socks at the same time. That's why they usually get lost in there."
I sat on the floor and put on my socks. When I finished getting on one sock, she said,
"That phone call earlier? That was my sister. When I told her that we were spending the night, she told me about the socks. So I could tell you if you couldn't find your socks. She said that if I did that, that would keep me in the driver's seat in our relationship, and that if a girl didn't act confident on her first night of sex, the guy might walk all over her."
I finished putting on my other sock. I grabbed my pants and got to my feet. When I put one leg into the pants, Sakurai said,
"This was going to be my first time. Even if it wasn't, I still would have been scared."
I finished zipping up my pants. I took the room key out of my pants pocket and left it on the side table next to the bed.
Sakurai said, "Please, say something."
As I walked toward the door, Sakurai said toward my back,
"My given name is Tsubaki, like Tsubaki from La Traviata. A name that has the kanji characters for cherry blossom and camellia sounds so Japanese that I didn't want you to know."
I put my hand on the doorknob. After wavering a bit, I turned around and said, "My real name is Lee, like Bruce Lee. My name sounds so foreign that I didn't want you to know because I was afraid of losing you, like I just did." I opened the door and went out into the corridor. As I slipped out the door, Sakurai seemed to say something, but I couldn't make out what. When I went back to the front desk, the young clerk seemed a bit wary about my sudden reappearance. I settled the bill and informed him that I would be the only one checking out. I expected his suspicion to grow stronger, but it didn't. The clerk was probably very well trained.
"How did you find the view?"
he asked after I'd paid the bill. I'd actually forgotten to take a look at the magnificent view. I lied and said it was fabulous. The clerk thanked me, smiled politely, and bowed. Although the trains were still running, I decided to walk home. I walked on a street parallel with the JR tracks and headed for Tokyo. When I reached Tokyo Station, I realized that I'd left my school uniform jacket in the locker. It was a chilly October night. I went past Tokyo Station and continued along the tracks toward Kanda. I went inside the convenience store in front of Kanda Station and bought myself a pack of short hopes and a cheap lighter. The young cashier took one look at me and opened his mouth to say something, but gave up when I glared at him. He handed me the cigarettes. It was the first cigarette I'd smoked in 4 years. I coughed at first, but soon found my old groove and smoked the whole pack by the time I got to Ueno.
The first convenience store I tried refused to sell me another pack, but the second store did not. I bought two packs just in case. Smoking my cigarettes, humming a tune, and walking across the guardrail like it was a high wire, I continued moving at a good clip. By the time I reached Nishinippori Station, it was past 3 in the morning. My house wasn't too much farther. Sometime after 4, I was back near my neighborhood of Hakusan. As I walked down the deserted residential street, I spotted a bike with its light on coming toward me. I let out a deep sigh. From the speed at which it was approaching, I instantly recognized the breed of human behind the wheel. I had a truly long relationship with these guys. In The Long Goodbye, Philip Marlowe said this about cops: "No way has yet been invented to say goodbye to them." I wondered what to do with the cigarettes and lighter. Once, in my first year of junior high, I was questioned by the police and had my belongings searched. Thanks to a pack of matches, I nearly was framed for being a serial arsonist who was going around starting fires at the time. The cop had asked, "What are you doing with these matches?" And I came up with a quip that Ikkyu-san might say, "I'm in charge of keeping the stove warm." Well, that seemed to sour the cop's mood and got me hauled down to the station and nearly framed for arson. I thought of ditching the cigarettes and lighter on the side of the street, but I stayed put, not wanting to arouse suspicion. The bicycle sped up a bit and made a beeline for me. At times, the bike light shone directly in my eyes and blinded me. "Hey, what are you doing here at this hour?" said the cop, climbing off the bicycle. His face was clouded with a dark look of suspicion and the cold-bloodedness of a predator eyeing his prey. Anticipating what might come next, I casually shifted position so the cop had to stand in front of his parked bike. "I was out with some friends and missed the last train, so I'm walking back home," I gave him a straight answer. "Where are you coming from?" When I told him Yurakucho, the young cop said, "That's far," and nodded as though he appreciated my efforts. Normally, the conversation would end here with, "Be careful getting home." But the guy was a pro. Maybe he'd gotten a scent of my junior high school days. "Where do you live?" he asked with a stern face. It was another textbook question. Now let's say I gave him my address. The young cop would get on the radio and have someone at the station check the resident register. At that point, it would come out that I'm Zainichi Korean. The young cop would be so informed. Then he would ask, "Do you have your alien registration card?" Japan used to have a law called the Alien Registration Law, which oversaw the foreigners living in Japan. Although "oversaw" had a nice ring to it, the law was basically there to put a collar on so-called bad foreigners. Despite being born and raised in Japan, I was still considered a foreign resident, so I was required to be registered as one and have an alien registration card. You were supposed to have this card on your person at all times, and not having it could get you a year of penal labor or imprisonment or a fine of 200,000 yen. Anyone who took off his collar would get disciplined. Since I wasn't some farm animal kept by the state, I refused to wear my collar, and I wasn't about to start now. So anyway, I was standing in front of this young cop in full violation of the law. "Well, why don't you answer?" the cop coaxed in a disagreeable tone. This was long past getting irritating, annoying, and tiresome. Philip Marlowe would have had a snappy comeback and talked his way out of this scrape, but I was no Philip Marlowe. So I decided to hit and run. In one efficient motion, I thrust out the palm of my hand and hit him in the Adam's apple. The cop let out a choked gasp, stumbling backward. With the bicycle parked right behind him, he wasn't able to get his balance, and he fell backward on the bike saddle. Unable to support his weight, the bike toppled sideways, carrying the cop with it. Just as I had planned. As soon as the cop stumbled, I took off running. The plan was to run out of sight before the cop had a chance to recover and chase me. I was confident that I could. I was used to police chases.
Behind me, I heard an unexpected sound. Thud. Slowing down, I turned around to see the young cop sprawled out on top of the fallen bike, completely still. His police cap had come off, leaving his bare head exposed. I slowed to a stop. He didn't look like he was faking. My sighs mixing with deep breaths, I thought about what to do. I decided to go back and check on him. Crouching next to the young cop, I put my right palm over his nose and my left palm against his carotid artery. The right picked up a steady breath, while the left felt a fast but steady pulse. I felt the back of his head. There was no bleeding. I looked around me. The street was deserted. I thought about running away and then noticed the gun hanging from the cop's waist. With my luck, there were plenty of ways that this could end badly. Letting out a long, long sigh, I picked up the police cap off the ground and stood up. I dragged the young cop's body to an empty space in the monthly parking lot nearby. I propped him up against the wall. I wheeled the bicycle to the lot, too, since there was nothing else to do but wait for the cop to regain consciousness. I decided to have a smoke. I sat on the pavement with my back against the wall and lit up a cigarette. I took a deep drag and exhaled deeply. I thought I heard birds chirping in the distance. Morning wasn't too far off. When I finished my cigarette, the young cop woke up. He lay there for a while, his eyes darting here and there, and tried to get a grasp on the situation. We locked eyes a couple of times. I smiled at him. I lit up another cigarette, and the cop sat up and felt around his body to see if anything was missing. I took out one bullet from your gun. When I said this, the cop smiled at me grimly. He slid his body closer and sat next to me with his back against the wall.
Give me one, said the young cop.
I gave him the whole pack. He pulled out a cigarette and stuck it in his mouth. I offered up the lighter and lit it. The cop brought his head closer and lit the end of his cigarette. He took a deep drag, exhaled, and said,
I'm not cut out for this job.
I looked at him, saying nothing. The cop continued.
I graduated from a sports science university, you know. I ended up a policeman because I couldn't find a company that'd take me. Since this is kind of a default job, my heart's not in it. Look at what you did to me back there. I was a handball player. I'm no good at that martial arts stuff.
That wouldn't have helped you, I said. It's a close combat move used by the American military.
Really?
I nodded and said. So you shouldn't get down on yourself. The young cop gave a relieved smile and savored his cigarette. For a while, I listened to the cop complain about this and that, about being bullied by his senpai, about his slim prospects of getting promoted, about not being able to find a girlfriend, stuff like that. And before I knew it, I was telling him everything about what happened with Sakurai at the hotel. The cop listened to my story intently. After I finished, he said,
Wow, I would have done it first and thought about telling her later. You're a better man than I am, he said. Good self-control.
Then he said, So which celebrity does she look like? When I thought about it and answered, I don't know, the cop got all weird and said,
Come on, help a guy out here. You can't put the brakes on my imagination like that.
She told me that I scared her, I said. To be honest, I was devastated.
I know what you're feeling,
the cop lit up his fourth cigarette and said, looking far away.
A girl once told me that I was gross.
That's harsh, I said.
Just thinking about it is enough to make me want to cry, even now.
It's best you forget about stuff like that, I said.
Can you forget what happened tonight so easily?
I shook my head.
Right?
Said the cop.
I really liked her. So did I.
The young cop blew smoke out of his nose.
Well, in my case, I got rejected before we even started dating.
I lit another cigarette, took a deep drag, and said, I didn't give a damn when someone discriminated against me. People that hate don't understand anything you try to tell them, so I just got used to hitting them. I wasn't ever going to lose a fight, so I was okay with it. Even if people like that continued to discriminate against me, I'd probably be okay with it. I took another drag and exhaled. But ever since I met her, I've been scared as hell. It was the first time I felt that way. I guess I've never met a Japanese person that I really cared about before. In the first place, I didn't exactly know how to treat her. And what if I told her about my background and she hated me? Once I got to thinking about that, I couldn't bring myself to tell her. Even when I believed she wasn't the kind of girl to be prejudiced. But I guess in the end, I didn't trust her. Sometimes I wish my skin was green or something. That way the good people will come closer and the haters will keep their distance. That would make things so much easier. We both fell silent and each smoked a cigarette to ash. Pulling out another cigarette, the young cop said, I had this senpai 3 years my senior in university, a Zainichi guy named Kim-sang, who everyone called Fearsome Kim. He had the fastest legs on the soccer team and was really strong. One time, he beat the hell out of some racists on the karate team, and from then on, he was called Fearsome Kim. I watched that fight. It was incredible. There wasn't a single wasted motion in his movements. I guess it was what you'd call artistic. He didn't seem human. One guy took one of Kim's uppercuts in the chin and lifted off the ground. That image is burned in my memory even now. Ever since I saw that, I idolized him. How do I explain it? It had nothing to do with him being Zainichi. I just looked up to Kim-sang. The young cop nodded again and again, muttering, He was something else, and lit his cigarette. I told the cop what I suspected might be Fearsome Kim's full name. The cop looked at me surprised and asked how I knew him. I explained to him that Fearsome Kim came to my junior high school as the new PE teacher during my second year and that he was feared by the students. I had a friend who was horrible at math. Probably couldn't recite the multiplication table, so he sure as hell wasn't going to follow the math lectures. One day, he ditched the midwinter endurance run in PE class and was taking a nap in the classroom near the stove when Fearsome Kim appeared. The young cop listened with rapt attention. Fearsome Kim walked right up, dragged the kid to his feet by the collar, and gave him a double slap in the face that nearly tore his head off. From that moment on, my friend was a whiz at math. The young cop let out a disbelieving puff of smoke and said, What? I said, After those slaps in the face, he went to the hospital complaining of a terrible headache. They found out his brain waves were scrambled. The young cop muttered, Kim's slap will do that to you. The headaches went away after a week, and all of a sudden, he could solve all those algebra and geometry problems he couldn't before. The same kid that used to say 4 times 9 is 28.
Are you serious?
It's true, I answered. Not only was he able to solve junior high level problems, he could do high school level problems and came to be called the biggest genius since the school's founding. I heard he's working on proving Fermat's theorem in high school now.
What is that? Is that harder than quadratic equations? Asked the cop.
The difference between Little League and the Major League. The young cop nodded like he was impressed.
Sounds like your friend owes Kim-san big.
Really? For slapping him silly? The cop said I should get going, put out his cigarette, and rose to his feet with his cap in hand. I stood up along with him. After patting me on the shoulder, the cop smiled a bit bashfully and said,
You should be like Fearsome Kim. Then you'd have all kinds of women hanging all over you.
I bowed my head and said, I'm sorry about earlier. The cop brought his mouth up to my ear and said, Let's just keep that between us. I nodded, laughing. The cop gave me an embarrassed smile. When I returned home, my father was waiting up for me.
What were you doing? He asked.
I left out the part about Sakurai and told him about hanging out with a cop I'd hit. My father let out a deep sigh and muttered, "Whatever." Then he asked, "Are you all right?" I nodded. After a quick shower, I went back to my room. I stacked all the novels, poetry collections, art books, photography books, and CDs that Jung-il had lent me in piles on my desk. 34 books and 16 CDs in all. I put Schubert's Winter Journey, one of Jung-il's favorites, on low and began paging through all of Jung-il's books. Flipping through the pages of Langston Hughes' poetry collection, I noticed a sticky note on one of the pages for the first time. It was a page with a short poem called Advice. I won't say any more about it. For as long as the poem remains unknown, it belongs only to me. No, it belongs only to me even if it does become known. By the time I got done going through all the books, the sun had come up, and it was time to get ready for school. After some thought, I decided to skip school. As soon as I decided, I began to cry. Putting my forehead down on the desk, I cried for almost an hour. It was the first time I'd cried in a really long time. I climbed right under the covers and wished Jung-il a good night before going to sleep. Good night. 6. Sakurai hadn't called since the night of Jung-il's funeral. I hadn't called her either. And then one night, about a week after the funeral, I got a call from Kato. "It's been a while." Kato's voice lacked energy. "How've you been? Good?"
"Yeah. Never mind that.
Why haven't you been in school?"
Kato hadn't been in school for almost a month.
"So you haven't heard any rumors yet?"
"Did something happen?" I asked.
"I got pinched by the police."
"Doing what?"
"Selling acid."
"Dumbass."
"Exactly."
"And?"
"I got sent to family court and somehow got off on probation. I've been seeing my probation officer every weekend, like we're dating or something. This dude is as cute as a button," he joked.
"We're going to get engaged soon."
"Dumbass." "Exactly."
"What are you going to do now?"
"My old man was fuming that I got kicked out of school. I guess he thought I was a good kid. Anyway, I guess I'll live like a Zen monk and play it humble for a while."
"Okay. Enjoy your ascetic training."
"By the way, how's it going with your snow spirit?"
"She melted and disappeared."
"So you guys are finished?"
"You heard me."
"Oh. Have you decided about your future?"
"I'm applying to university."
"What's this all of a sudden?"
"A dying wish of a friend."
"What?"
"I'll tell you about it sometime. Anyway, I've been studying for the entrance exams."
"I'm sure you'll get in."
"You think?"
"Definitely. But if you're going to go through the trouble, you might as well get into a really good school, and then you can breathe the air up there for me."
"The air up there ain't nothing but thin and dirty."
"That's perfect. I mean, you're used to that."
We both let out a laugh.
"I'll come and see you soon," I said. "Nah, better not," replied Kato.
"What's the matter?"
After a brief silence, Kato said, "I don't plan on seeing you for a while. As dumb as I am, I got to thinking after that incident at the club, and that's what I decided. I've been expecting too many people to carry me. I've been half-assed and pathetic. When I saw you going down the stairs to punch that kid, Kobayashi, I realized I'd never measure up to you. So until I can stand on my own 2 feet and get to where you are, I've decided that I'm not going to see you."
"I'm not the person you think I am."
"Look, maybe to you you're just being normal, but not to me. I can't just be the Yakuza's son anymore. It's not enough. It's not enough if I want to catch up to you. I have to look good and hard for my own thing. It isn't always easy being Japanese either,
Kato chuckled sheepishly.
I said, when I get into a really great university, I'll call you. Who knows how long that'll take. Hey, when that happens, I'll throw you a huge party. Say hi to your father for me.
I'll tell him.
I said, see you. And Kato said, later. And we each hung up the phone. Around the start of November, a new challenger appeared before me. He was a second year who'd mistakenly gotten it into his head that I'd become depressed without Kato around to back me. I put him away in a minute. That was a personal best. Thus, I was still undefeated with a 25-0 record. But just how long did I have to keep fighting like this anyway? With Kato out of the picture, I didn't have anyone to talk to, so I concentrated on the entrance exams. I spent the breaks between classes and my lunch hour studying. When school ended, I went straight home and did my usual training routine and guitar practice, and then studied until morning. Oh, and I picked up Spanish as a breather between studying for the exams. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro. Buenos días. Muchas gracias. Adiós. Hasta la vista. My parents had another fight, and my mother left the house again. This time, it was about my mother wanting to get a driver's license. Whatever. There were a lot of rainy days. I focused on my studies, at times listening to the gloomy echo of raindrops. On a rainy day toward the end of November, an unfamiliar face approached my desk during lunch hour. The voices in the gallery died down, and everyone around me moved off to the corners of the classroom. I closed the classic study guide I'd been reading and got into combat mode. The kid had a faint smile on his lips, as if to show he came in peace.
"Can I talk to you for a minute?"
He had a soft voice. He was wearing silver-rimmed glasses. You had to be some kind of fighter if you were going to pick a fight with your glasses on. This kid didn't look like any kind of fighter. I nodded, and the kid turned the chair from the desk in front of me around and sat down. The conversations in the gallery picked up again.
"My name is Miyamoto. You don't know me, do you?"
he asked. I answered honestly.
Miyamoto said, "That figures," and gave me a broad smile. "We've been in the same year for 3 years.
"What do you want?" I asked. The smile vanished from Miyamoto's face. He casually looked around him and said in a flat voice,
"I'm actually Zainichi, like you."
Miyamoto waited for some kind of response. A positive one, probably. I gave him nothing. A hint of disappointment came over his face.
"Unlike you, I've gone through the Japanese school system, so I don't know Korean or anything about Korean history or culture. But I'm still Korean. It's weird, don't you think?"
I said nothing and stared at his face. Miyamoto continued, unbothered.
"If I had been born in America, I'd be called Korean-American and would have all the rights accorded to an American citizen. I'd be treated like I was human. But this country is different. If I become a model person, more so than any Japanese, I still won't be treated like a proper human as long as I have Korean citizenship. The way a sumo wrestler can't become a stable master while he still has foreign citizenship. Assimilation or exclusion. There are only two choices in this country."
"Then why don't you change your citizenship to Japanese?" I said. An obvious look of disappointment came over Miyamoto's face.
"Are you saying that I should admit defeat to this country?"
"What defeat? What are you fighting anyway? What, is your ethnic pride so fragile that it would disappear just by changing your citizenship?"
Miyamoto sighed and said, "Look, we don't have a lot of time left, so I'll tell you why I'm here. I'm trying to get all the young Zainichi together to form a group. We don't discriminate between North and South Korean or between Chongryong and Mindang. We already have close to 100 members. I'm asking if you'd join our group. I know we'd be a lot stronger with someone like you on our side." Miyamoto peered into my eyes as if to coax an answer out of me. As I sat there saying nothing, he said, "Can I ask you something?" I nodded. "You have South Korean citizenship, right?" I nodded again. Miyamoto continued, "If you don't have any qualms about changing your citizenship, then why are you still South Korean?" I didn't answer. A faint smile flickering on the edges of his lips, Miyamoto said, "Please don't tell me it's because it doesn't affect the way you live. What about having to report to the government office every couple of years under the pretense of switching your alien registration? Or what about having to apply for a re-entry permit before going overseas? We were born and raised here, and yet we have to ask permission to be allowed back in? Doesn't it all